Okay, so this is ITE1, Module 15, Advanced Networking. So in this chapter, you will be the objectives are to identify potential safety hazards and implement proper safety procedures related to networks, design a network based on the customer's needs, determine the components for your customer's network, implement the customer's network, upgrade the customer's network, describe installation, configuration and management of a simple mail server, describe preventative maintenance procedures for networks and troubleshoot networks.
Now just a reminder, if you haven't read Cavi Announced, this lecture is on advanced networking because Josh is off to WWDC and will be doing all things Apple. So his lecture comes first. So we apologize for anybody who may have pre-read.
Okay, so to meet the expectations and needs of customers, and network users, a technician must be familiar with network technologies. A technician must understand the basics of how a network is designed and why some components affect the flow of data on a network. Okay, so topics include in the chapter advanced networking topics including network design, network component upgrades and email server installations. Basic networking topics such as safety, network components and preventative maintenance, and troubleshooting advanced network situations. Okay, so first, safety procedures. Basically, when you're doing like designing, building your networks and so forth, sometimes you might have to say crawl through roofs and things like that. So it's always might have to strip wires or whatever. So it's always a good idea to look at or know the basic safety procedures you need. So say for instance you were crawling through a roof, a good thing to know would be to wear say long pants, long sleeve shirt, decent eyewear, because you don't know what's going to be there. It might be dust, might be hazardous materials they've stored up there, whatever. So it's always a good idea to consider that. Okay, the other thing you might have to do is when you're installing cables, say up fairly high, you might have to use a ladder, and it's always a good idea to know whatever the safety precautions are with that. So for instance, don't stand on the top rung, put for instance safety cones or notify people that you're going to be working on the ladder out, and so they know that it's there so they don't walk into it and knock you off. And follow any other safety rules that are applied. Usually there's a list that come with the ladder or whatever.
Wouldn't that be a bit dangerous to be a totally blind person climbing around on the roof and stuff if you didn't know what was there? I think I would rather somebody else do that.
You're not really going to probably be doing that often.
You're not going to be doing that. This course is going, aimed at people who would potentially have cabling licenses and who would potentially be cable installers.
And you need to know all the safety stuff in case you're supervising someone else as well.
Yeah, that's true. I just was like, ooh, that's a scary picture to have in my head of me doing that.
Yeah, that's your final, didn't you know?
Oh, really?
We're joking, by the way, just in case anybody's listening to this recording. No, you do. I'm just letting everybody else know.
Okay, and the last thing is basically just use any common sense when doing anything like that. Usually that should do. Okay, so fiber optic safety. Fiber optics are useful for communication, but they have certain hazards. They do contain dangerous chemicals, obviously light that you can't see, and which can hurt your eyes. And to build things with fiber optic, use tools with fairly sharp edges, and they produce glass fibers, so got to be careful of that. Some of the different stuff you use when working with fiber optic, a lot of solvents and glues, like I said, tools with sharp edges, have that cut glass so you can get that into your hands or whatever. And like, always obtain proper training before you start pulling apart things like fiber optic.
I don't know whether anybody's aware of how nasty glass fibers can be, but because they don't actually break down in very much except for strong acids, if they get into your eyes or your fingers or your bloodstream or whatever, it can be really bad news. So if you don't know what you're doing with optical fiber, then don't. Leave it to a qualified installer.
And another good thing about with glass is, you know, if you put glass into, say, a plastic bag and then go walk, you know, 2 meters, just watch the glass not break through the bag, and you can potentially do that to your skin as well. So cable safety. Know the hazards before working with network cable and equipment. When handling cable, always wear eye protection. Never touch the ends of any type of cable with bare skin. The reason is they can have sharp ends, or the little metal fibers. When with all the tools that you use, similar to like the fiber optic ones, they can have sharp ends. So next, though, that pretty much covers all the safety stuff. Okay, so next we have network design. So basically, a network will work best if it's designed to meet the needs of your customers. When you're thinking about designing a network, always analyze the environment that you're going to install it in. Understand the options that you have available to you. Interview the customer to see what their needs are. List any hardware and software that you're going to need to get. And always consider future growth as a main thing for designing a network, because just because it works today, there might be something 10 times better that's gonna come out, say a new router or something, and if you're still running on 10 megabit, you know, Ethernet, then your network's going to be pretty bad. And as well, like for as an example, say you go out into a business environment where all they do is, say, use like a document production type place, there's not really going to be a great need to install gigabit Ethernet and that sort of thing. Or so always think about that. Okay, so network topology. A site survey is a physical inspection of the building that will help determine a basic logical topology, which is the flow of data and protocols. Considerations for topology choices, basically the number of number and location of users, cable and wireless types, and expandability. And can you guys name the different types of topologies?
Well, there's ring and star and extended star, and there's other ones too.
I'll give you a cryptic clue.
Oh yeah, bus topology.
Good.
Sadly, that actually helped.
Okay, so you guys know the basic features of those, like obviously a bus is a straight line, a ring topology, all computers, first computers connected to the next computers connected to, like, say the third computer and so forth, and the third computer is connected back to the first one, and a star is everything's connected to a central point.
Oh, and okay. The other one.
Good. Okay, so protocol ports. When the TCP/IP protocol stack is enabled, other protocols become available on specific ports. Any of you can name any of the protocols?
POP3, SMTP, IMAP, FTP, HTTP.
Good. Okay, and in the notes there's actually a table with a listing of the different ports. For instance, HTTP is on port 80, Telnet SSH 23 and 22, for instance, like that. And it's a good idea to know the basic ones, like, for instance, Telnet SSH HTTP.
Wasn't there a Wikipedia link a while back?
There is a list underlined ports on Wikipedia. There's also a more human readable list of ports on www.grc.com. I always find Wikipedia articles, whilst very informative, are massively huge tables that compare about 600 gazillion things, and actually finding the information you want can be a bit of a challenge. For an example of this, have a look at list of HTC devices, and that will bend your mind.
Or a list of Linux distributions. That one's good too.
Comparison of media player.
Yeah, that's another good one. You're quiet, Grace.
Drew's quiet too.
Am I quiet too, am I?
No, you're nice and loud and that's...
Okay, one other thing is don't always guarantee that it's definitely going to be on a given port because you can change them.
And in fact, if you're setting up Gmail, you must follow the exact curriculum, the curriculums. I'm looking at curriculum and directions here. directions. So that you can actually put like one on 995 and one on 487 and stuff. And if I had a dollar for every time somebody asked me, how do I set up Yahoo with POP3? Or how do I set up Gmail with POP3 or IMAP or whatever? And you really should use IMAP if you're using Gmail. I would strongly recommend that you actually go in and pull up their help documentation and follow it rather than just guessing.
It is very good once you find it and you do follow it through. It is good.
Thunderbird 3 tries to guess at it also, which is kind of useful.
Yeah.
And it usually does a good job.
The iPod guessed at it really well. The iPod did it really well.
Yeah, guessing is good, but sometimes if they require some sort of TLS and it's not there, or it does require to... For example, Thunderbird on my network guesses that you need to use TLS for your sending mail, and that is so not true. Just because my mail server responds to TLS, Thunderbird, does not mean you actually should be using it. So just be careful of the auto detection.
Okay, so next we have the components of a network. So the network topology chosen determines the type of devices, cables, and network interface that will be required to construct the network. A connection to an internet service provider must be established. Okay, next we have cable... Sorry, what were you saying?
We lost you after the bit about the ISP.
Oh, I was saying, the connection to the ISP has to be established.
Oh, okay. I thought there was more to that sentence, and then it didn't.
Okay, next we have cable types. So you have to think about what cable type is going to be most beneficial and cost-effective for the customer. So, for instance, types of twisted pair cables could be Cat5, Cat5e, Cat6, Cat6a. Cat5e is the most common type of cable used in a network and is fairly cheap. Cat6a is the most recent type of cable and carries a signal of a data rate of 10 gigabits a second. I can't remember the exact length of Cat6a, but I know it carries it pretty far.
No, I think it's still 100 meters. Depends what speed you're running across. We'd have to look that up, but as far as I recollect, it's still 100 meters on Cat 6. You can theoretically run gigabit on Cat 5e, but you should be running it on Cat 6. Is basically what it comes down to.
Isn't that 380 feet or something?
328.
328. Okay.
Oops. That's okay. We don't use feet over here, so it's not a problem. But for you guys, 328 feet.
Okay, so next, considerations for your cable choice. Installing cables is expensive, but after a one-time expense, a wired network is normally inexpensive to maintain. This is true if you pick the right cable. For instance, you pick, Category 5e cable, and then get a gigabit router and you run your cables too far, you're going to have to rewire the entire thing. So always make sure that you choose that appropriately. To make a wireless network as secure, and that's in quotes, because you can't really make a wireless network as secure as a wired network, it requires the use of encryption. Install the highest grade cable available to ensure the network will handle future network speeds, like I was saying before. And a wireless solution may be possible to places where cables cannot be installed. Okay, next we have your ISP connection types. Do you guys remember covering that before?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. So, considerations when selecting an ISP connection type. Obviously, speed is the main one. Reliability, availability, and cost. So, for instance, DSL, low cost. A problem is that it must be close to the carrier, and speed is between 256k and 24 megabits. Cable, very high speed. Problem is that it has slow upload speeds and ranges between 384 and 27 megabits. And satellite, available when DSL and cable are not, that's an advantage. Disadvantage is that it has significant lag, more expensive than broadband, and operates between 9 kilobits and 24 megabits. And wireless.
I was just going to put a quick story in here. We actually had a student in 2007 who the only internet access they could get was satellite link. And interestingly enough, under Skype, he was perfectly understandable. However, there was about a 1.5 second latency between talking to him and the satellite. So you'd have to wait for his replies to come back. But he was absolutely unintelligible under Ventrilo. It just went. And we never figured out why. Okay, sorry, back onto wireless. I was just adding that in because that was quite an interesting experience to have one of our students on satellite. And no, this was Ventrilo.
Yeah, Skype is really good at low bandwidth, but Ventrilo, not so much.
Well, the bandwidth wasn't the issue. It was actually the latency that was the problem. Our Ventrilo server only uses 1,700 bytes per second. How much lower bandwidth do you want?
Yeah, I meant latency.
And for extra points, define latency.
It's the delay between of the response between one connection point and another one.
Yeah, pretty much. It's the time taken for a packet to travel from its source to its destination, how long the packet actually takes to make that trip. Okay, sorry, Josh, back to wireless.
Alright. So, wireless advantages. Scalable to customers' needs. Disadvantage is very expensive and limited market available. And runs up to 45 megabits a second.
Are you talking about cellular now?
Wireless can go fast. You can get 600 megabits on wireless these days. Well, you can get hundreds of megabits on wireless now. Like,
let's end. I think this is before. Well, no, it wasn't either. Huh.
Hang on, Josh, are you talking about Wi-Fi or are you
talking
about
wireless? Any wireless. Any wireless. ISP wireless, it just depends where you are. I mean, these notes are pretty out of date, so I'd take their bandwidth readings with a grain of salt because things have advanced a lot. How fast is that thing that Neil's on? Yeah, one of our ex-students who now works as a TAFE lecturer is getting 8 megabits on a Vivid wireless mobile dongle. Yeah, it depends on where he is in the house.
Okay, so next we have network interface cards. Considerations include speed, form factor, and capabilities of network interface card and or hub or switch. Most network interface cards for desktops are either integrated into the motherboard or an expansion card that fits into an expansion slot. Most network interface cards for laptops and are either integrated into the motherboard or fit into a PC card on the express bus expansion slot. USB adapters obviously plug into any available USB port and can be used with both desktops and laptops. Okay, next we have devices. Hubs. You guys know what a hub is?
It takes a signal from one signal and puts it back out to all of the other ones. It makes me think of one of those headphone splitting things that we used to have.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
They're a bit more smart than the headphone splitters because...
I'm sure they are, but...
Yeah, but they do essentially do a similar thing. They take one signal and shovel it out both ports.
Okay, what about switches?
I always have trouble with those.
Okay, opposite of a router. Basically, whereas a router gets information in and forwards it out to all other interfaces, a switch can filter traffic, so therefore segments the network. So, because it only sends to the desired, you know, destination device. What about routers? Do you guys remember about routers?
Anyone?
That's what you were saying.
I talked about them yesterday, Drew.
Yes. Yeah.
Earth to Drew.
You're in Discovery.
Yeah, I'm in Discovery. Yes, routers.
What's a router, Drew?
Usually meant to router is meant to take one internet signal and split it among four other computers and also allow those four computers to network together and share files and folders and printers and things.
You're really quiet, though.
Keep,
I'm not sure
keep,
you're gonna come
keep,
out
keep,
the...
sorry. He is. Keep digging, okay? That's not quite what a router, I would say a router is. Do you want to have another shot?
Well, it contains a bridge that connects to the network portion.
That's a home router. But I'm talking about the general definition of a router.
Okay.
The average student would have probably scrabbled up a copy of whatis.com at this point and had a look at what it actually said. But a router is actually a device that allows you to route packets between disparate subnets. So you've got multiple subnets and multiple interfaces, and it allows you to route information between the various subnets.
Okay, and lastly we have ISP equipment, so obviously DSL modem or cable modem, whatever it may be.
And they're starting to combine the home router and the modem into the same box.
Does anyone know what that's called?
Which one?
When you combined multiple networking services into one box?
No, but I want to...
If you think about what you're actually doing, like integrating, so... The system's called Integrated Services.
An ISR, an Integrated Services Router.
Okay, so next we have an installation checklist. So, careful planning will help ensure an easier and faster network installation. Basically, you want to make sure all parts are in, installation is scheduled, backups are available, you have access to any needed passwords, you have extra supplies handy, and make sure you install the components and test components. Okay, so network installation. To install cable in ceilings and behind walls, perform a cable pull. Terminate each end of every cable, label the ends of every cable. Test the cables for shorts or interference. Install network interface cards in network devices. Configure client software and IP address information. Install switches and routers in a secured central location. Install patch cables from wall connections to devices and check network interface cards for link lights on all devices, or you can ping the interface once the computer's on. Test the network for connectivity. Configure and test network applications.
I have a tangent-y thing. Is it still possible to get light probes? So that if you did actually want to check lights on things, can you still...
If you have a Symbian phone, you can get a free one.
If you don't, yes, you can get light probes. He doesn't have a Symbian phone.
No, I don't.
Also, the voice will let you do some light probe work, but it's nowhere near as accurate as, say, using a little light probe that you can hold over a specific LED.
Okay, so next we have configuring web browsers. So to configure the settings... So the idea is to configure settings and perform maintenance tasks. To do that, go Microsoft Internet Explorer, Tools menu, Internet Options. Good idea to occasionally delete the temporary internet files and cookies and things like that.
Just a point, that is a valid thing to want to do. Also note, however, that as of Internet Explorer 7, Internet Explorer usually limits your temporary internet folder to 20 meg of disk space, and in fact, if it's set any higher than 20 megs, it will tend to warn you if you go into the settings dialog. But for older computers and stuff, it is certainly worth emptying those temporary internet files, and there are times when you will need to empty your temporary internet folder for debugging and diagnostic purposes.
And some people actually want their cookies.
Sorry, some people actually what, sorry?
So some people actually want their cookies.
Yeah, but you can actually retain the cookies without emptying the temporary internet folder. You can delete the cookies, but in fact, I am one of the people who wants my cookies. I actually uncheck the boxes in CCleaner so that it does not delete my cookies, because that saves me having to re-log into LiveJournal and everything again.
Yeah, that's why I like them too. And for some people, if you took away their cookies, they would absolutely freak.
Oh yeah, because all their passwords are stored in their cookies.
Yeah.
Very insecure.
No, why is that insecure?
Because some of the cookies, the passwords are actually stored in plain text. They're not always a hash, so if you go sifting through their cookies, you can find out what their passwords are.
Okay, so next we'll move on to sharing network resources. Okay, share a single file, multiple folders filled with files and folders on an entire drive. So that's the obviously the goal. Obviously have a folder on your computer which you want to nominate as your sharing folder. Don't just share out the entire C drive or whatever. Which I've seen that done fairly regularly. So, right click the folder and select sharing and security. Select share the folder. Identify who can access the folder and which permissions they have. And also that's can be a good security purpose, because that way you're not sharing everything on your system, you're only sharing the things you want to share, and you keep all your other information private.
Is there a security risk if you're sharing drives that aren't your OS drive?
Is there a security risk if you're sharing out drives other than your OS drive?
Yes.
Well, if you want people to go ahead and delete your stuff, then sure.
There
you can
is.
Take away write privileges.
You can take away write permissions, but the other thing you've got to keep in mind is that as soon as you share out drives on any computer, the computer actually starts announcing its presence on the network. So Drewy's box will show up on the network and people will be able to see it, whereas if you have no shared resources, it doesn't announce itself in the browser services. So you might not want it to announce itself on the network, so having nothing shared out is often a good idea.
Also, if you're sharing stuff on a FAT32 drive, you can't really specify, as far as I know, who has access to what. You can't really go on a user-per-user thing. Am I correct on that? For individual files.
Say that again, you what?
If let's say you share part of your FAT32 drive, I don't think you can actually say, okay, Drew can use it, but Carrie can't because of the permissions and stuff, am I right?
That's correct. Yeah, there. On a FAT file system, the only permissions you've got are share-based permissions. So you can actually set permissions on the share and say Drew can get in and Kerry can't. But you can't actually set fine-grained file system permissions. And there's a difference between file system level permissions and share level permissions.
So if Kerry can get in, then he can basically read and write and do whatever.
No, you can say read-only. You can share resources as read-only. One of the things you've got to keep in mind is that all of the sharing stuff has changed under Windows 7. Under Windows XP Home, you actually only get simple file sharing. So the only choices you've got is read-write or read-only. You do not get the fine-grained user control. It's only XP Professional that gives you the fine-grained user control.
Okay, so next we have sharing printers. Basically, select Start, Control Panel, Printers and Folders, Printers and Faxes, sorry, and you can basically share it out from there. Okay, so next we have Network Upgrades. So you must be able to upgrade, install, and configure components when a customer asks for increased speed, new function,
Hang on, I just got something about printers real quick. While sharing the printer is easy, sometimes getting the other computer to actually see the shared printer and talk to it can be a pain in the you know what.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm having that on Vista, and now the admin person can access the printer, but her son, who's not an admin user, can't. And I'm just like, you've got to be kidding me.
That's because Vista's a crock. I'm sorry.
Pretty much, yeah.
File sharing, it's a little messy.
Upgrade it to Windows 7, and we'll have far fewer problems.
I remember when Vista first came out, I did tried to do some work on a person's machine, and basically, even as the super user, you couldn't actually install programs.
Grace, I think you're mic'd up.
And you're humming.
Oh, I am mic'd up.
And you're humming.
Yeah.
That's
your lovely 50
Is that better?
Hertz Australian hum that I don't hear very often, and it's cool.
No, it's so not cool. Am I humming still?
A little, not as much as you were.
Must bring another headset.
Gotta love those cheap Skype headsets, hey? They all do this. The microphone inserts get wiggly, and the only way to stop them from humming is to actually wiggle the microphone around with it unmuted until it stops humming, and it'll go and stop humming. So.
Okay, so next, installing and configuring wireless adapters. Before purchasing a wireless adapter, make sure it is compatible with other wireless equipment that is already installed on the network. To install a PCI wireless adapter, the adapter must be the correct form factor to fit the computer. So obviously remove the case cover, install the network interface card into an open PCI slot or PCI Express slot, configure device drives, VERS rather, and enter network address information. Now, before I said to remove the case cover, there's something I forgot to mention. What's that?
Unplug everything.
Good, so make sure the power's off. Oh, and of course, one other thing. You guys remember it? Something about static electricity.
Oh, where are your anti-static wrist straps? And
of course. Good.
That's useful.
Okay, so next, installing and configuring wireless routers. So position the wireless router for maximum coverage. Connect the wireless router to the existing network. So connect a DSL or cable modem to the wireless router. Connect one computer to any of the remaining ports to access the configuration websites. But most of the routers now you get are ISRs, so you don't have to worry about having like separate devices. Turn on the broadband modem and plug in the power cord to the router. When the modem finishes establishing a connection to the ISP, the router will automatically communicate with the modem to receive network information from the ISP. IP address, subnet mask, and DNS server addresses, for instance. Okay, so to test a network connection, anyone of you guys know a really easy way to test a network connection?
Repinging it.
There's one good way, and to test internet connectivity?
Just try and go somewhere with a browser.
Very good. Okay, so the connection status screen is available and displays the number of packets that have been sent and received. Sometimes that gets pretty handy. It also tells you the duration that you've been connected for. Obviously tells you that you're connected and gives you the speed. And in a wireless one, it shows you the signal strength. And I don't know if that one's accessible or not in Windows.
Which one?
It depends on. He's talking about.
Oh, the ZeroConf wireless.
In the network. If you're using NVDA, it does.
The actual ZeroConf wireless that you configure is accessible in Windows. Yeah. The signal strength only ever says poor, good, excellent.
He wasn't sure about that part.
Yeah, it says poor, good, excellent. Yeah, it does. It does actually say that, and it does pop up in balloons. And there is an unknown Jaws keystroke that will give you the contents of those balloons, but nobody can remember it.
I think that was an 8 that they added that.
Okay. So next we have the support tab of the connection status. It allows you to view the MAC address and other information of the card. Shows you how you're getting your actual internet address. For instance, is it static or dynamic? Rather, IP address.
Are you talking about on the router, or are you talking about in Windows?
Just in Windows. Sorry, so it's not internet address. Okay. It's IP address. Allows you to reset the connection information and establish a new connection.
And how do you get to that tab?
In the actual status box. Along the top, there's two tabs, so if you press Control tab, it should take you from the general one to the support one for each interface that you have connected.
Oh, okay.
So you press Enter on the network adapter, not Alt Enter, and then you can Control tab across to the support tab, and there's actually some quite readable and cut and pastable read-only edit fields that you can actually pull the information out of.
Okay, so next we have the IP config commands. All right. I'll say the command, and if you guys know what it does, then yell out, alright? So, ipconfig/all.
It gives you all of the IP-related information for every single adapter in the computer.
Good. ipconfig/release.
Someone other than Sean.
Sorry, what was the question?
ipconfig/release, what does it do?
Oh, yeah, that takes away your IP address from the DHT server.
Hey, this support thing is really cool. I just went and looked at it. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know it's hiding there, but it's actually quite good, and it'll do basic troubleshooting, and one of the basic troubleshooting will be release renew. Yes, Drew, you are correct. It releases the lease on the IP address from the DHCP server.
Yeah, I think if you click details, it'll all show up in a list that you can just select and copy.
Yeah, it just...
Okay, what about ipconfig/renew?
That would give you a new IP address from the DHCP server.
Good. Okay, then you have IP...
I think he's not sure of himself, so he gets quiet when he's unsure of himself.
No, I knew that answer. It's just if I move this microphone 2 inches to the side, then no one can hear me because it's cardio.
Yeah, these audio files. Get a $5, Fry's microphone.
It's a $20 microphone, okay?
That was worth the bet.
Yeah, but it... Yeah, your $5 mic will be just fine.
This isn't like a $300 Neumann. This is $20.
Yeah, but it's still cardioid and it presents you with problems, so get something that isn't.
Yeah, it's not.
To be fair, though, Sean, most PC power supplies provide, and this is nothing to do with the lecture, but they do provide phantom power, and most PCs expect to see a condenser microphone or a powered mic, so there you go.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I've had it work with ones that aren't powered, but that's interesting, or that aren't...
Often microphones that aren't powered are really, really quiet. Like, if you put a dynamic microphone into a PC, you won't get any volume. Anyway, back to the lecture.
Okay, so next we have the ping command. So to confirm that your adapter is working properly, ping your network interface card. So obviously start, run, CMD. At the command prompt type, enter ping space localhost. Anyone know the other thing you can use besides localhost?
Do you mean the 127.0.0.1?
Good.
There's actually a t-shirt that says there's no place, or a doormat that says there's no place like 127.0.0.1.
I think that's a t-shirt too. Yeah, that's great. It should be
a
t-shirt.
Both.
It's a great, wear it at parties.
Yeah.
We used to have people dropping onto the Linux channels going, where can I get all of the wares from? And we'd type in http://127.0.0.1.
Okay.
Some people wanting to learn how to hack stuff, and they're just telling them to mass ping themselves offline.
Okay, so to confirm that your wireless, wide area connection is working properly, ping the default gateway. So you go find the address for the router. You can use the ipconfig command for that, and then just obviously punch in ping space and then whatever your gateway address is. And you can test internet connection by pinging a popular website or the DNS server.
However, note that Microsoft's website does not respond to pings. I'm just checking.
But I think I understand why.
They will not reply to any ICMP because people used to ping flood them off the net. Yeah, so you just get requests timed out from www.microsoft.com.
That was what Blaster was supposed to do.
One time we were having problems with the other event server, and so I pinged it to make sure it was still alive, and I felt very smart for trying that.
Ah, and did it respond?
Yeah, it was. It turned out that there was a financial issue, and the bill hadn't gotten auto-deducted. But I was like, oh, we'll try it anyway.
I had a similar issue happen, but not with the Ventrilo server. I was assistant network admin for my local college, and the internet went down, and everyone's calling, and I'm trying to, hearts in my mouth, throat, trying to figure out what the freaking problem is, and I'm logging, and I'm pinging all over the place, and all the internal things are fine. I hadn't paid their bill for the internet. Oops.
That
wasn't my fault.
Lots of upset students, eh?
Yeah. It was summer vacation, so it wasn't that big a deal, but still.
Okay, so next we have the trace route command, or trace ert command. Trace is the route that packets take from your computer to a destination address. So once again, start run CMD at the command prompt, enter trace it. The first listing in the window for the trace it result is your default gateway, and each listing after that is the router that packets go to reach the destination.
And you said it's trace.
So it says trace. It's TRACERT on Windows.
and trace route on Mac and Linux and real operating systems.
I think we covered before in Discovery that there's actually a utility in OS X where you can, it's like a graphical utility.
Network utility's cool.
Yeah, is that accessible with your screen readers and stuff?
It seems decent, yeah. I mean, I don't probably know 1/9 of what it can do, but the little bit I did see was cool, and that I knew what to do with.
Oh, cool. If it's accessible, even better. Okay, so Tracer will show you where packets are stopping, indicating where the problem is occurring.
It shows a star if the router that it is tracing doesn't return a reply, so there are actually some routers that will not actually return the ICMP, so you get *** as going through those hops, but I have actually seen trace routes where like hops 5 and 6 go *** and then hops 7 and 8 start returning stuff.
Yeah, I saw that too. I was confused.
Okay, so next we have email protocols. Okay, first one, SMTP. Advantages are delivers email from one server to another, can send mail directly to the destination. Disadvantages are client upload only, works on port 25. Okay, next we have POP. Simple, supports intermittent connections. Disadvantages are that it's download only and cannot manage the mail on the server, and operates at port 110 by default. Next we have IMAP, advantages being that it's simple, has more features than POP, stores mail on the server faster than POP, and it allows simultaneous access by multiple clients. And disadvantages are that it requires more disk space and CPU resources. And this one operates by default on port 143. But like I said before,
I've heard a number of people complain that they think IMAP is slow, and I'm like, no.
Well, it is. It is in a way, because what actually happens is when you actually send a command to the remote mail server, let's say there's 500 milliseconds latency between you and Google. When you hit the delete command, it can actually take up to a second, or a bit over a second, for the response to actually come back. And it'll actually look as though the mail system is responding sluggishly. But what's actually happening is it's taking time for those commands to actually get out to the mail server, be responded upon, and then reply back. People expect email to respond lightning fast when they're working on a server that's a couple of, you know, states away. That's not the case. What POP does is it often marks the messages as deleted and then deletes them as a batch, but then what happens if you close out of your email client incorrectly or whatever, then the messages don't get deleted and people complain that the messages are coming down twice, so you can't win.
I used to use a thing called JBmail that nobody else seemed to use, and it just connected straight to the POP server and basically stayed there until you had decided you wanted to delete all the messages. And if you deleted something and you said you wanted to actually delete it, you hit Alt+F4 to close it, and if you wanted to save your changes, you actually had to hit Alt+X. But I really liked it, and everybody said, why are you using that? Because I like it. Except I don't.
Fair enough.
If you want to see lightning fast email, be on your own email server in your house. It's crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
She's got a gigabit Ethernet connection to the mail server. It's quite fast. As soon as you delete things, they're gone.
Spoiled, are we?
Yeah, she is just a bit. I should limit to 10 megabits for a day.
That'd be cruel.
Retro network experience.
How much would it take to set up your own mail server?
It doesn't take that much to set up your own mail server.
I don't imagine it. Yeah.
No, this is internally accessible. This is on our LAN. We've got probably 5 or 6 computers on our LAN. So the mail server is 24.2. And I have a Linux box set up running a mail server. If you wanted to run your own mail server, the cheapest and most effective way for you to do it would be to actually run a virtual Linux machine and set the mail server up on the virtual Linux machine and get it to grab another IP off your router, and you could just connect into the virtual machine when it was booted and check and read and reply to your mail. In fact, I've been known to do that when I'm on holidays when my mail server isn't with me. It's like, make a virtual one and take it with you.
Technology is cool.
But if you're going to play with that sort of stuff, I'd get your hands on a Linode or something from Hostlatch, which is like really cheap, or build your own virtual Linux box, or download a VMware virtual appliance that already has like the I don't want to think web interface configured, so that you can go in and mess with it. There's actually web interface controlled virtual appliances, so you can just go, I want these four user accounts, clicky, clicky, bang, bang. And it's all good.
Cool.
I don't want you think to say, that sounds perfect for me. I do need to get virtual VMware.
Well, given the fact that you're doing ITE1, it would be a good time to go and get a copy of VMware Player off the works and get the test virtual machine and do and start working on your module 11 and up labs.
Have play. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
And Grace is humming again.
Hence my...
I spent like 4 hours Saturday working on these virtual machines. Guys, use them. They're great.
I will use it. Do not worry.
I spent 4 hours on Saturday telling somebody how to do virtual machines.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Okay, so next, setting up email servers. So Active Directory servers, global cabling servers, global catalog servers, and domain name servers must all be in place and functioning before Exchange can be installed and working properly. So, test the environment before installing Exchange. Set up the services required and install Exchange on the dedicated set of servers away from the main network. Keep the installation of Exchange separated from your production network until you are sure that it is functioning properly. Okay, so next, prepare for the installation. So be prepared with proper equipment and information. So DNS deployment, Active Directory domain, at least one global catalog, Windows 2000 or higher native domain functionality, Exchange server software, Windows server support, and high-speed internet. Keep in mind these notes are pretty old, so... Okay, so next, to actually install it, so add internet information services using the add remove Windows components wizard before installing the installation of Exchange server. Insert the Exchange CD. So these, I assume, are based on Windows 2000 server?
Yeah, they are. And I think 2003 server as well, but not 2008 server. I'd probably just sort of skim over this bit and let them read that in their notes, because I don't believe that stuff shows up in the test.
Yeah, I was just thinking that myself. Okay, so next we have preventative maintenance. So you want to be checking the condition of cables, network devices, servers, and computers to make sure that they are kept clean and are in good working order. Develop a plan to perform scheduled maintenance and cleaning at regular intervals. This one's pretty important, and you've got to keep on top of it. If you notice equipment is failing, damaged, or making unusual sounds, and inform the network administrator to prevent unnecessary network downtime. I heard a story recently where a server room in a certain place, basically one of the staff members walked in, and as they were walking past the server room, they sort of could feel this like mass generation of like heat coming from the walls. They went and notified the network administrator, and it turns out the air conditioning had broken over the course of the weekend. And that got fixed pretty quickly, but nevertheless could have been pretty detrimental to the network.
Oh, I was afraid you were going to say something called fire.
Josh is just taking a phone call. So he just killed a phone call.
Well, that was fat.
Okay, so educate network users on by demonstrating to them how to properly connect, disconnect, and move cables. Yeah, see, that statement can be beneficial sometimes, but obviously not all the time. Okay, and
some people probably just shouldn't play with cables.
Or computers, for that matter. So yeah, like I was saying before, with that one, obviously, some people, they can do things and they can't do things, and I suppose, like, you'll see what people can and can't do, so. Alright, and lastly, we have the troubleshooting process. So, who can name the steps in the troubleshooting process?
Let's What's step one? One person, one... Okay, Drew, what's step one of the troubleshooting process?
Step one is... Is that the one? Or that is... Blah, 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 blah. That is observing... I'm trying to remember the words, and I'm already screwed up. Step one is observing obvious problems. Is that correct, or is that step two?
No!
No.
Not even close.
Asking closed, is it open, ended questions.
Step one is gathering data from the customer.
One of the two. Gathering data.
Step two?
Yeah, can we do any better with step two? Shall we pick on you for step two?
Yeah, I think we should.
Was step two eliminate obvious issues?
Step.
Sean, what's step three? Any idea?
Try quick solutions first.
Absolutely.
Step four. Back to you, Drew.
Right.
Since you've only got two people now.
Yeah, if you can encourage more students to turn up to lecture, you won't get asked as many questions.
Exactly.
See, I don't mind being asked questions. Maybe I'm just, you know.
You're just super motivated. That's awesome.
Step four. Anyone for step four?
I completely failed to recall step four, and this hilarious failure will be documented.
Gathering
for all
data
to see
from
the
computer.
Next 10 years.
Look
good.
Let's just say, without going too far, that we're a little bit disappointed that the troubleshooting process isn't as well known by all of our students. And it's not just you, Drew. It's all of you. It seems that Mr. Thiel is in.
Except
and
Sean
because
he
knows it.
I've only seen it about 900 times as I've been reading this stuff.
Yeah, you just kind of pick it up. It somehow just kind of sticks with you, and you'll never,
and
ever,
you get,
it'll
like,
never
the same
go away.
Diagrams. You get, like, the same diagrams over and over, almost the same.
I think they just cut and paste the table into, like, every module in IT.
They probably do. They probably do.
Okay. So, step five, anyone?
Actually, let's go with step six first, just to throw things in.
All right. What's step six, anyone?
With the customer.
It is.
And step five?
Solve problem. Fix.
Oh!
Yeah, we evaluate the problem and implement the solution.
That's right. Evaluate the problem. You solve the problem and then evaluate the solution. That is correct.
Yeah.
May I suggest that before you sit the final exam, and this goes to all of your students, if any of you were sitting and you're behind your little audio players and were feeling a little bit nervous and queasy as to not knowing the troubleshooting process, may I suggest we revise it before the final test? End of community announcement.
That's one thing I can guarantee you will be in the final.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Sean and Drew have taken their finals. Is it in the final, guys?
Yes, it's in there.
Yes,